This episode is brought to you by Chiefs on Broadway. There's a different way to experience live music in Nashville. Eric Church's Chiefs on Broadway is home to the Neon Steeple, an intimate live music venue in the heart of downtown Nashville, where artists and songwriters take the stage for up-close, unforgettable shows. From stripped-down sets to surprise guests, no two nights are the same. Check out the Neon Steeple lineup and get your tickets now at chiefsonbroadway.com. It's June, and we believe there's no time quite like the summer to enjoy some country music. BGS is leaning into all things quality country with our sister site, Good Country. This month's edition of Good Country highlights Artist of the Month, Jody Messina, and we have sit-downs with Braxton Keith, the Broody Brothers, and Ashley McBride. Dive in at thebluegrasssituation.com/goodcountry.
They say there's nothing new under the sun, and ain't that the truth? The Working Songwriter has been on the air for over 10 years and 300 episodes now. As you've probably noticed, only the latest 100 published episodes are available in your podcast app and on Spotify. So we're bringing some of the gems from past years back. Of course, if you want to access every single episode of the show at any time, you can become a subscriber to The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website, joepugmusic.com, where you can access any episode of the show for streaming and for download. In the meantime, we're bringing back some classic episodes to the main feed. Is that a reason to not join The Vault? Of course not, because it means that our latest episodes will only get paywalled all the sooner. Is this a relatively convoluted system? Of course it is, but such are the trade-offs that the ever-changing media landscape leaves us to navigate. Thank you for being here. It's always an honor that you listen to the show, and I hope that you enjoy some of these classic episodes. Today's episode with Leanne Womack was originally aired on June 29th, 2018. A brief scan of the headlines of that day remind us that Fortnite was reaching its peak cultural influence, and millennials were being blamed for killing department stores. Simpler times. I hope that you enjoy this classic episode. My guest this morning fell in love with music as a child in East Texas, helping her father pick out records to play in his role as a disc jockey. Leanne Womack attended school briefly in Levelland, Texas, long enough to be a member of the school band, Country Caravan, before settling in Nashville to attend Belmont University and study the business of music. She began playing some songs of her own at showcases around town and was discovered and signed by Tree Publishings. That led her to writing songs with Nashville luminaries such as Bill Anderson and Ricky Skaggs. In 1996, her self-titled debut climbed the Billboard Country charts, won her recognition from the Academy of Country Music Awards and the American Music Awards. That early success was multiplied in 2000 when she released the song that would become one of her calling cards, I Hope You Dance. It became a juggernaut that spanned the country, pop, and adult contemporary charts. In 2014, she signed with Sugar Hill Records and released an album in a style closer to her East Texas origins of classic country and roots music. She's continued in that vein with her latest effort, The Lonely, The Lonesome, and The Gone, via ATO Records. The New York Times has described it as an album embodying the most delicate and desperate extremes of melancholy. She's been nominated for so many awards that we'd need an entirely separate program to list them all. And she's coming on our plucky little program today, and for that, we are very, very grateful. Please give a warm welcome to Leanne Womack. I'd like you to. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? I'm a little.
Still working on your sea legs?
Yes.
Yeah, me too, to a certain degree. Well, maybe through reverie of a different time, we can. That can act as our Dramamine for today. Mm. I want you to take me back to Jacksonville, Texas. Your mom is a teacher. Your dad is a principal. But it sounds like your dad is also moonlighting as a DJ at night. So can you take me to some of your earliest memories of music with him?
Mm-hmm. Well, I hung out at the studio a lot, at the station a lot with him, because it was a real small town, and mm-hmm. so he would be there a lot by himself. It was a very small station. So my mom was going back to school to get her master's degree, and instead of getting a babysitter, she would drop me off there. So I spent a lot of time
smart mom.
At the station. I don't know if she feels so smart now about leaving me there all the time.
was he doing a set program for an hour a day, or would he just be in there playing songs for a whole morning? What was he up to?
Well, this was the station at a time when they could play, on-air personalities could kind of play what they wanted, you know, within what was in the catalog there. So, he just played a lot of music and did the weather and all the stuff that you do in a small-town radio station. He did a lot of remotes, so I went to a lot of parades and openings and things like that, you know. And it was a big part of our life just because, it was what he did. He eventually went back and got his teaching certificate and then administrators and all that, became principal and everything. But for a long time, that was all he did.
Did he play?
Play music? No. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. He was just a
yep.
fan.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, what music were you turned on to then that would later manifest itself in your later work?
Well, he had a lot of Bob Wills stuff, records and stuff, and a lot of Ray Price. So very Texas swing and shuffle kind of stuff in his own personal catalog. And then he was playing, stuff that was popular in country at the time, like Glen Campbell. And even funny stuff like Ray Stevens and of course, you know, being in Texas, Willie Nelson and a lot of real Texas oriented music.
Was that the music that your friends and contemporaries were listening to at the time?
Well, this I'm speaking now of when I was a really little child. So I really don't know what it was. Either for me, it was either church music or my dad's record collection. So that was all. It was all I had.
Sure.
So I don't know what my friends, what other little kids were listening to. I don't know.
Sure, sure. So that was an earlier time in your life before
yeah.
teenager
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you moved to Nashville. You're at Belmont. You take some time off to start a family before embarking on a career of your own. What was it like to start a family and then dive back into music to get your start?
It definitely affected everything I did. The fact that I already had a child when I signed a record deal and a publishing deal to write songs. First of all, it affected who I was and, you know, the things that I did every day. And the way I looked at the world and all that, but also just time constraints and things, you know. And so then Aubrey, that was my first child, Aubrey spent a lot of time with me in writing sessions and in recording sessions.
Would she really?
And,
she
oh,
came
yeah.
to writing sessions with you?
Oh, yes. And she was so quiet and so good. But I couldn't afford a babysitter at that point. So, yeah, she would come with me a lot. And maybe I'd be writing with somebody who had kids and they would play, you know, and that sort of thing. But
yeah. But
she definitely grew up in the business.
Who were you writing with at that time before your self-titled debut came out?
My first husband, her dad, Jason mm-hmm. Sellers, and Billy Joe Foster was one of our co-writers, a guy from Oklahoma who played in Ricky Skaggs' band and was a fiddle player and a mandolin player. And great, we wrote a song called "Am I the Only Thing You've Done Wrong?" It was on my first record. And I don't remember forgetting, which Ricky Skaggs ended up cutting. And so we wrote a lot. And then I wrote with a guy named Randy Hardison, Wynn Barbel, just a lot of these, my early friends there in Nashville.
What were the skills that you were learning then that you needed to learn about the craft? You can just pick one or two.
I remember Billy Joe Foster telling me, you know, you should just... don't try to sound eloquent or anything. Just write down what's in your head, you know, write down really what you're feeling, and then you can kind of switch it around and make it rhyme or whatever, but just, you know, get it on paper, you know, what you're actually feeling.
Speak a truth first.
Yes.
And then turn it into, not exactly poetry, but, yeah. Well, you know, I think lyrics and poetry are different things just because lyrics are coming at you in real time, you know, whereas poetry, you control how fast you read it, you know, but...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. When did you, so it was Tree Publishings that signed you
mm-hmm.
at the time?
Yep.
The first?
And they signed me, they came out and heard me at a showcase, and they heard me sing "Am I the Only Thing You've Done Wrong?" and a few other songs that I had written at that point. But they mostly signed me as an artist. I mean, they thought we can get her, you know, on our roster and writing songs, she's going to cut them all herself because she's going to get a record deal, we feel pretty certain, you know.
Gotcha.
It's kind of part of their development program, kind of. I'm not sure exactly what they called it, but they signed me knowing that I was probably going to get a record deal, betting on the fact that I would.
You've said in interviews before that one of the main impetuses for you writing songs is the songs that were being provided to you just weren't saying what you wanted to say. So, first of all, what were those songs saying that you didn't want to say at the time?
Well, in a nutshell, you know, like you said, I grew up in East Texas listening to hardcore country music, George Jones and the stuff that Willie was writing or had written in the 60s, you know, and I had my idea of what country music was, and I wanted to cut those kinds of songs. By the time I got to Nashville, they weren't making real country music anymore. It was really starting off on the whole pop thing. So they weren't writing songs like "Am I the Only Thing You've Done Wrong?" or, you know, things that I really wanted to say and the way I wanted to say them. So that's why I started writing.
So what are some of those themes that you find yourself coming back to? Like, what do you think would be some archetypal themes from classic country music that you find yourself returning to?
Well, I always thought of country music as real country music as being a sort of a blues, you know. I mean, it's kind of for the working man and that sort of thing, and for adults, really, you know, themes and things. And it's really gotten to be sort of a teeny bopper, kind of more of a, you know, feel. And so, and I was always an old soul, even when because I had Aubrey when I was 22. So I was, you know, I don't know. I listened to George Jones when I was 5 years old, you know, so I just never really was into pop music. And there's some great pop music, and I've made some pop records, you know, but so I don't have anything against it. It's just that it just wasn't what I really loved.
Yeah. Well, especially since you took on so much responsibility at a young age. I mean, when you take on responsibility, that's when you really start seeing the really kind of dark and difficult sides of life, you know, when you have something to lose.
Like that. And, you know, it's funny. I had great parents, and I had a great childhood, and my parents worked hard, and we didn't have a whole lot of extras, but I never wondered where my next meal was coming from or anything, you know?
Yeah.
But I just always had this melancholy sort of part of me that really related to, Tammy Wynette, you know, when she was singing about having a broken heart or whatever. I might not have understood exactly what those songs were about, but I understood the feel of it. And I think I was lonely as a child. And so I just think those kinds of things spoke to me even early on.
Were you lonely? Did you have siblings or not have siblings? Mm-hmm.
I had one sister that wasn't real fond of me, and she was quite a bit older than I was, and so I pretty much was on my own.
That's a charitable way of putting it. So once you're up there in Nashville and getting started, and speaking of your parents there, what were they thinking of you heading into the music business? Were they supportive of you? Mm-hmm. Were they excited for you?
Yeah, I mean, it always worried them that I wasn't going to college because they were both college people, you know, and educators. They were educators. And so, and it still bothers them, I think, that I never finished because I came really close. But I ended up getting a publishing, you know, getting paid to write songs. And I thought, well, I don't need to finish this degree now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I think it still bothers them. I think they still are like, oh my gosh, I hope Leanne gets her degree. So she'll have something to fall back on. I think that still goes through their heads.
That would lead a parent to worry about education, even after their kid has made it big, is certainly ripe for satire. But maybe it's not misguided. A lot of us were brought up under the battle cry of follow your dreams. But to do that, you got to pay your bills along the way. That's a pretty big fly in the ointment. It sounds like Leanne's father made peace between his practical side and his love of music by running his radio show, even as he worked as a principal to pay the bills. And there is a kind of freedom that arrives when you divorce your creative pursuit from your income. The best I've heard that feeling described was in a New York Times Magazine profile of the short story writer George Saunders. He had lived in Los Angeles for a time but couldn't find work and was forced to leave the city. The next chapter of his life would unfold very differently because of what he learned from that experience in a kind of render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's revelation that he had. Here's how the New York Times described it. He met Paula, who was in the writing program, shortly after he arrived in Syracuse. They were engaged after 3 weeks, and Paula became pregnant 7 months later on their honeymoon. We went from being young Carver acolyte beatniks to Ozzie and Harriet in what felt like a week, he said. Well, Ozzie and Harriet if they were broke. In 1989, when their daughter Caitlin was one, they moved to Rochester so Saunders could work as a technical writer for the Radian Corporation. Their second daughter, Elena, was born a year later. With both daughters, Paula went into labor at 5 months and had to go on complete bed rest. At one point, their car broke down, and Saunders biked back and forth to work along the Erie Canal in a cold-weather moon suit cobbled together from a set of lab goggles, a rain poncho, some high rubber boots that I seem to remember had little spacemen on them. If it's possible to locate the exact moment when George Saunders became George Saunders, it's right around here. I was so terrified by that L.A. experience, he said. I couldn't imagine getting to that place with Paula and the girls. So I took the Radian job, and it was a very liberating thing. If I can provide for them, then in my writing time, I can be as wild as I want. Having felt that abyss, I basically said, "Okay, capitalism, I have seen your gaping maw, and I want no trouble with you." Remember a specific moment when your debut comes out, and obviously it was very successful. Do you remember a moment, an acute specific moment, where you were like, wow, this is happening, it's working, and my dreams are coming true here?
Yeah, I remember the house that I was living in, and I remember the night that Don Cook, who's a great writer and producer in Nashville. He was working with Brooks and Dunn at the time, and I remember him calling me, and he was at Sony Tree at the publishing company that I told you had signed me, you know, in the hopes of getting me a record deal. And I remember him calling me and saying, "Okay, I got Tony Brown and Mark Wright both, you know, really excited about signing you, and so we've got some decisions to make, and we've got some things to think about." And I remember standing there in that little kitchen thinking, "This is it. This, here we go." And I was, you know, like I said, I was a mom already, and I was in my late 20s, so I wasn't a kid anymore, you know. And I had, there were times when I thought, you know, oh, my chance has passed me by. I'm not going to get a record deal anymore. So it was a big moment for me.
Man, that's got to be a good feeling.
It was, yes.
So a couple years after that release, your career is going, things are going well, and then you release "I Hope You Dance," and you've been quoted saying to your husband at some point after that came out, "I think they expect me to be Billy Graham now," which I think is hilarious. Mm-hmm. So can you speak that to me as you saying something like you felt a certain pressure, uh-huh. and what was that pressure and what did that feel like?
Okay, so the song "I Hope You Dance," when I heard it, I thought, "Oh, that's a cool song," you know, and it made me think about Aubrey and Anna and all the, you know, how I felt as a mother and all the things I wanted for them in their life and that sort of thing. But I didn't think, "Oh my gosh, this is going to be a smash hit," you know, yeah. that's going to cross over on different genres and be recorded in different languages and all. I didn't think about all that.
Right.
So, to me, it was simple. It was a simple thing, but it became this very complicated thing. And what I meant about the Billy Graham thing was that I felt like people were coming to me with their problems and wanting answers. And I was the girl who was, you know, wanted to be the female George Jones. You know, I wanted to sing drinking songs, and you know, and so I was like, oh my goodness, I kept feeling like they were wanting me to say, you know, well, let's bow our heads in prayer, and let's, you know, and I understand all that because I grew up that way, and so maybe that's why I felt the way I did, but I wasn't a healing person, you know. If anything, I'm on the other side, you know. I need that from other people.
Right,
so
right.
It was just a weird time for me,
mm-hmm.
With the whole thing of I Hope You Dance. Now, as I'm older and I look back, and I've had a lot of other successes as well, I'm very, very grateful to have that song because I get to be a part of people's lives in a way that most artists never do and never will get to. So when people think about their high school graduation, or when they think about when they gave birth to their child, or when they think about how they thought they weren't going to be able to get through a divorce, and then all of a sudden this song lifted them up, you know, I mean, I get to be a part of people's lives in that way. When mm-hmm. they think about those monumental moments, they associate, you know, me or the song with it, and my voice with it, and I mean, it's what a gift.
What a gift.
Yeah.
What a gift. And you're honoring that gift. I heard some people have complicated relationships with the songs that brought them to extreme international prominence. But the best I've ever heard it said is someone asked Tony Bennett what he thought about singing I Left My Heart in San Francisco every night. And he said, that song gave me the keys to the world. How could I not love it?
Right, you know? Right. I've definitely come full circle with I Hope You Dance.
Fast forward to today. You're working on an album or a writing session. What does a perfect creative day look like for you? Not a perfect outcome, but for you, a perfect process. Are you at home? Are you at the studio?
Well, you mean for writing?
For writing specifically, yeah.
A great, great day for me is when I get a great hook or a great idea for a song. And I'm really excited about it.
Does that come while you're sitting down to intentionally do that? Or does that come while you're working in the garden or, you know,
usually it just comes from life.
Yeah.
Like my assistant came in one day and she had a picture of me and I was in a bathing suit and I was a lot younger and a lot thinner and I said, she goes, what? She was laughing going, when was this taken? And I said, oh, I don't know. I can guarantee you that was 20 years and two husbands ago. And that, you know, and I was like, yeah. And especially if it's a real country hook like that, you know, I mean,
totally.
I just love that.
Gold. I can go take 2 weeks at the beach now.
I love it. And that's exciting to me, you know, to have something like that to work on.
That nugget of a song.
Exactly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
But I also enjoy finding songs like that as well.
Okay. Well, how do you do that?
Frank will bring them to me and he'll go, listen to this, you know, and I'll never forget when I first heard, I May Hate Myself in the Morning, but I'm going to love you tonight. And I was like, oh my gosh, what a great country hook, you know?
Yes.
And that to me is just, I live for that. I love that. And I love to sing songs that songwriters wrote and then they're not singers. So I get to
interpret,
deliver that.
Yeah. Yeah, all those titles are just classic, timeless. Pop them in any decade.
Exactly.
In what ways do you think your writing process has most significantly changed since you started? Or has it?
Well, it has. Well, I'm harder. When I first started writing songs, I wasn't so concerned about being great at it. Because I thought, you know, well, nobody's great when they first start. But then once you have some success, then you start trying to measure up to that every time. So that's changed in that I'm probably more scared to write now than I ever have been.
Yeah. More scared in the sense, yeah, I guess when you're really getting started, you're like, well, if I do this badly, it literally does not matter.
Right. When you're first starting, right. Yeah. Now it's like, am I going to expose myself as being horrible, you know?
So how do you, I mean, I guess the question would be, how can you trick yourself into that kind of beginner's mindset, you know?
Yeah, and I try, I do, and I get it done, but it's probably a little scarier than it used to be.
Well, how do you get it done?
Discipline and the help of friends, and I'll go to somebody and say, maybe it's Adam Wright or Waylon Payne or Dean Dillon or whatever, and I'll say, here's what I have, and Dean's really good about going, well, here's what I would do, and here's how I would change. So I have good friends.
You have kind of a coterie of several people whose opinion is kind of like a rock.
Yes,
that'll
definitely
tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to find people that'll tell you the truth about the song sometimes.
Well, not Dean Dillon. He'll tell you.
Good. That's a valuable friend and a valuable colleague, for sure. Your career has spanned so many different kind of eras, and you've worked with so many different companies. It's very unusual. It's hard to have that sort of sustained success. What do you think, and this could even be a lesson music aside, what do you think leads to, what character traits do you think lead to sustained professional achievement?
Well, one thing for me is I can't do anything else. So I just have to keep going.
Yeah.
and I've had successes and failures and things like that. But I really do feel like I was born to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one part of it. And I can't do anything else. So I don't feel like I should be doing anything else. So
that's a good way to keep you going.
Yeah.
What would you consider to be the most difficult professional obstacle you've had to overcome to get where you are now?
Definitely, honestly, I Hope You Dance is somewhat of an albatross, because it was the big pop crossover thing, and being on a commercial record label, they make money. They're happy to say we don't make art, we make money, and so those kinds of things are hard for somebody that really, to be honest with you, I just don't care about, it's terrible to say, and I'm sure my husband's here, he's probably cringing, but I just don't care about money. I just never did. I don't know, it never was an issue for me when I was, we didn't have much, so and I knew I didn't have money to spend. I don't know, it just never was an issue for me.
Yeah.
I like to travel, there's things I like to do, but I never made music for money, and I still don't, and thank goodness I have people who can watch the bottom line, because you have to, you have to make some money to keep going, and pay people and all that kind of stuff, but it was never a motivating factor for me. So that was a difficult part, that it was and continues to be a difficult part in going forward.
Was it difficult in the sense that that success brought you opportunities that you had to stand up and say no to?
Yes, I say no
so,
a lot.
Like, what are some of those that have been difficult?
All
to kinds
of things. Like, if you'll get on social media and open up this box of products and say, "Oh, I love these candles," or "I love this," we'll pay you, $20,000. No, I'm not doing that. My fans can't afford those candles, and right. That's just one small thing. I get offers for dates for things that I would never do, tours for things I would never do, and I say no all the time, much to the chagrin of the business people that do work with me, but.
There's a very funny account of Alec Baldwin talking to Jerry Seinfeld, and he said, if I was as successful as you were, I'd just sit in a chair with a phone next to me and I'd pick it up every 10 minutes and go, no.
So, yeah.
Looking back at your years in music, what are you most grateful for?
Well, first and foremost, that I'm able to do what I love. I was a little girl and thinking, I want to make records, I want to sing for a living, but I realized that most people don't ever get to actually do it. A lot of people have that dream, but they don't get to act. So just getting to do it is the most rewarding thing.
Yeah, or a lot of people get to do it, but one hit does not make another. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's hard to sustain that every time.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said earlier, I don't really know how to do anything else. But one of the things I think that can keep me going is that I don't have to have it all. I had it. I've been there.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't make me happy. I can be really happy when I figure out a new chord on the guitar and I'm sitting by myself in my bedroom at home, you know. I can just sit and play and sing, and that I get a great deal of satisfaction out of that. Mm-hmm. I don't have to be in front of 10,000 people.
Yeah.
It comes from inside and not so much from somebody giving it to me. It's like in there. So that's another thing that just keeps me going.
Do you think you had to reach that height and still feel a level of like normal human dissatisfaction that's just baseline with the human condition? Do you think you had to reach that height and feel that to arrive at the place that you're at now?
No.
Or have you always been there?
Well, I think I've always been there, but that definitely helped me to realize for sure that, and what really helps me to be able to do is tell my daughters, the things that you think are going to make you happy might not be the things, you know. And I'm able to tell them because I've been through it.
Yeah.
So that's probably the best part of it.
And finally, what's it been like? Your daughter is entering the music business now. What has it been like watching her go through that, and how much are you involved in advising her or giving her room to grow on her own?
I'm perfectly fine. Like, I know a lot of people who do what I do say, you know, don't tell their kids don't get in the business or don't be an artist or whatever. I would never do that, because to have that inside of you and not pursue it, because the pursuit is the good part. That's the fun part. It's not the reaching, you know, the pinnacle. It's the dream and the goal and the getting there and the work and the that's the fun part. So I would never tell them not to do it. I don't give her advice, because she actually grew up in the business. Like I said, in recording studios, at writing sessions, on a tour bus. You know, she knows way more about the business than I ever did.
It's her native environment.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And so, and plus she has a great manager and producer and all these people that I want her to have the best. Like, if I was her manager or her advisor, she would not have the best. She would have, you know, a jaded artist who's been through her own experience, you know. So I want her to have the best. So, and if I'm doing that, then who's being mom? You know, who's taking care of the cats when she goes on tour? Who's
getting her mail? Songs.
Yeah. I'm still taking care of my own career.
Yeah. Well, I'm so grateful that you stopped by the show today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for letting us travel with you.
Leanne Womack, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Yeah.